Session so that I can make it available to you if you want it. Don't feel like you have to have it later, but in particular so that you have the practice that we'll do. If you want to listen back over that or tweak it, make it your own, you would then have the option, because they always come out differently, and I'm quite sure how it will be, so we shall see. So I've got the kind of graveyard slot, the post-lunchtime investigation into whether consciousness survives lunchtime and digestion. Apparently it does, as everybody is wide awake and bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. So this is a very big subject, clearly, and not one I'm going to be comprehensive on in 40 minutes, particularly as about 20 of those minutes at least will be experiential. But I'll try and say something vaguely coherent about mindfulness itself, and about how it might be relevant or useful to you in the various different roles that you're all playing, multiple hats, but the major theme being coaching, because that's the business of today. I guess I should say something about why I'm stood here. Simple reason is it's Keith Sylvester.
My fault.
Well, I had an email from Keith saying, well, are you free on this day? Would you consider coming to talk about mindfulness, which I'm very, very happy to be doing. So I'm a psychosynthesis therapist based in South Wales. Prior experience in the prison system as a therapist, I hasten to add. and although at times it was hard to tell. And also within the university higher education kind of sector, but these days, the last 4 or 5 years, in self-employment, so mainly therapy clients, supervision, and what I hadn't thought of as coaching until reflecting on this today. It turns out I do some coaching, which I hadn't really thought of in those terms. Most of it has come my way through mindfulness, as I do operate as a mindfulness teacher. Again, slightly in the role of an interloper, never formally trained in the various ways. It came from my experience in Tibetan Buddhism and being invited to teach, and then really experientially being kind of grandparented into running mindfulness courses since about 2002. So that's why I'm stood here. I'm also, for my sins, involved with the spirituality division of the BACP. For those of you that are in the therapy kind of world, so I'm on their executive committee. That's probably all that needs to be said about that. And I am currently about halfway through what is called the Orphan Wisdom School. So I'm a scholar of the Orphan Wisdom School, which is basically a kind of way of inquiring into, if we kept it really simple, into grief. So that's another thing that informs my practice and my work. I'm very happy to speak more about all of these things afterwards if you catch me in a break or before the end of the day. So let's see if I can make the thing move on. Okay, so I thought I'd start with a simple couple of lines from Auden, the poet, who says, "We would rather be ruined than changed. We would rather die in our dread than climb the cross of the moment and let our illusions die." Which is quite a beautifully put diagnostic description of, I think, probably or arguably one of the kind of meta or master symptoms of the modern experience, that of anxiety. It comes from his poem The Age of Anxiety, written in 1947, so this is not new. And we've begun to touch on some of those themes with the different workshops and the different presentations we've already heard today. So I'm bringing that in partly as one of the things that might be a threat to us as practitioners, as coaches, as supervisors, as therapists, or just as human beings, to our well-being, to our state of health and balance. That perhaps one could say anxiety is one of those conditions of living in this time and this place, that whether we feel it very personally or whether we just move through it and through the people in our day, it's something that we're all going to relate to and have an experience of. And from a very sort of technical mindfulness point of view, there's a sort of slightly counterintuitive thing about anxiety. So maybe therapeutically, broadly speaking, when we work with anxiety, we might focus on the anxiety and attempt one way or another to reduce it or to shrink the context in which it's arising. which clearly has a lot going for it and is a very valuable approach. But what that potentially misses, and what's present certainly in the Tibetan understanding of what we call anxiety, would be its, they would say, its near enemy or its opponent force. And it turns out that the opponent force of anxiety is joy. In other words, rather than trying to make less anxiety, make more joy, and you automatically lessen the anxiety. So this fits very well, I think, as a starting point with Assagioli's way of being in the world and his writings, for those of you schooled in psychosynthesis, smiling wisdom and so on and so forth. So just a shout out for joy. So I often give clients homework to just be more joyful, find something that might express, you know, one iota more joy than you were feeling yesterday. Or perhaps it might fit with things like gratitude, just noticing where joy erupts in your day or in your life or in your relationships. Okay, so let's move on. I wanted to say a little bit about some resources, and these clearly are going to be very brief and very cherry-picked. There are countless more resources than we're going to happen upon today, and really I'm not going to say much about them because there isn't time, but if any of them pique your interest or just produce a response and you want to know more or to challenge them or whatever, please catch me afterwards. So I wasn't sophisticated enough to have them slide in like people do on PowerPoint, so they're just all there from the beginning in no particular order really. So one of the tools that could be of interest and value to you and overlaps a lot, I think, with certain things that came up at the end of the, for those that were in the talk about the VUCA world earlier on. I'm not sure what the kind of axis or graph that got drawn at the end was. I took a photo of it, but but this perhaps has a comparable measure to that. So the Big Five aspect scale is a kind of personality measure, you could say, that takes five validated aspects of personality, which are openness, conscientiousness, the extroversion, introversion line, agreeableness, and neuroticism. So each of them has a polarity, of course. So if you imagine a kind of, it would be a sort of pentagram shape, something with five axes that you could create by answering questions about yourself. So it's a self-awareness tool, basically, so that you can know where your susceptibilities to things like stress or anxiety might come in. You know, if you score very highly as an agreeable person, you might find conflict very difficult. And when you have plenty of conflict in succession, you might suddenly find yourself feeling really tired. It sounds obvious when you say it, but maybe not so easy to spot outside of those reflections. So it's a very handy, very simple measure that feeds into various other things one can do as well, which I think do have a mappability onto psychosynthesis. So where we might talk in terms of ideal model, and in coaching terms, as we heard this morning, certain where do you want to be in 3 months or 5 months, 6 months, 3 years, all of that. Coming from that Big Five aspect scale, there are things like there's one called the self-authoring suite, which is about, you know, my future self, how would it be, how would it look, how would it feel? And indeed, there are mindfulness exercises that rest on a very similar, technically it becomes almost tantric understanding, because it operates as if future time is in existence right now. So you behave as, or as if, again, a very Assagiolian point, the power of as if. Is this making sense? Yeah? Yeah. Interesting that that also maps onto anxiety. As somebody once said, the most anxiety-creating phrase in the English language has to do with what if. So the movement from what if to as if might be one way of holding that shift. What if it inevitably conjures up a kind of worst-case scenario for most of us most of the time, whereas as if gives us a little bit more empowerment, a little bit more groundedness, a little bit more say, perhaps, at the level of self, certainly, as it expresses down. So then there's a few more exercises. So the second one there is building a compassionate self-image, which is basically exactly what it describes. You spend time when you are not in a stimulated state of anxiety, crafting for yourself on a number of levels, and the more detailed you can be, the better, a self-image that is compassionate, that offers you, you know, if you were feeling soothed or secure, for example, where would you be, and visually what would that look like, and sensorially what would that feel like, what would it sound like, and you give it a lot of detail, and you build that through practice, as with so many things. And maybe we'll hear a bit more about it from the neuroscience perspective later. Repetition, or practice as it's usually called, builds these kind of resiliences and generates the, or works with the neuroplasticity that can change certain otherwise seemingly hardwired situations. So some of the qualities that might go with the compassionate self-image, they might vary, but they might have a core thing that you return to, like receiving wisdom or being afloat in a kind of non-judgmental kind of space, or in something that lends you strength or connects you to your own kind of strength and flexibility. So there's a sort of, you could almost say, a sort of spiritual technology around this that's well known, but often we forget the well known. So I'm just serving as a reminder. The next one, harm versus nurture, again, a very simple thought tool with a kind of diagram between it, basically walks people through the idea of what would your red lights look like? What are the typical feedback loops that let you know you're stressed, or let you know you're becoming anxious, or let you know you've wobbled off from your usual centre into some other state? So it might be, I suddenly can't sleep, or my appetite's just gone completely, or, you know, I just withdraw and I don't ring people anymore, or, you know, just all the very, very simple, but having them kind of articulated helps us spot them more effectively. Having spotted them, we then get into this sort of tension between harm and nurture. So what would it look like if I didn't address any of these, if I just let it go? If I kept doing that or kept neglecting that, what would happen? What would be the next sequence or cascade of events? And alongside that, what would happen if I did turn towards them, recognize them, engage with them, and where possible, make the kind of shifts and changes? And the final stage of that practice has to do with a kind of developing or growing aspect of mastery, self-mastery, a kind of sense of getting better at noticing those red lights and immediately responding to them, rather than having to go through the whole process. So it has a kind of efficiency gain, if you like, in that kind of language that's rooted in it as well. Then we have patience, which clearly is an important quality for all of us working in the ways we do with other people. The patience practice I had in mind comes from somebody called Gil Fronsel, and very familiar, I think, to people who are working in a psychosynthesis way. It basically, in a nutshell, involves what we would call disidentification. A zooming out is how it's described, literally like a camera panning out, very Asagiolian, to come to as wide a view. And that's something that we visualize all the time, especially if you use Google Earth or anything like that these days. It's you pan out, you have a wider view. So that's the first move. Then there's a phase of reconnecting and releasing. So you start to notice what it is that you can now see from that perspective. And then you zoom back in. So you make the other journey. You come right back down to that scale of being an individual, being a self with a small s. And perhaps this relates to something that Roger said earlier on. From that place, you start to notice what in this model is called the small stuff. So the small next step, I think, was how it was said earlier on. It's possible, suddenly, having done the up and come back in, to be more acute in our noticing. It's as if something in our vision is more attuned. And the final stage is attuning to that change, cooperating with it, lending your weight to it. So if you think about balance physically, it's dynamic. It's not a fixed and static point. It depends what you're doing, how you're standing, where you are. It moves around. You know, if I sit down, my point of balance shifts. Same thing. How do I cooperate with this small change that might be needed or emerging, having been patient with it? And then the final one on the list there, the compassionate friend. So this is sort of most fully articulated by Paul Gilbert, for those of you familiar with his work. And in in some of his work, he talks about a visualization practice, really, where you imagine a being. So it could be, you know, one of the great beings of the world traditions. You might be visited by Christ or the Buddha or Krishna or whomever. Or it might be someone that you know, someone from your own life, living or dead. Or it might be a more idealized form, a kind of blending or combination of people. It doesn't really matter. You simply visualize that very clearly and you receive that person as a visitor. So there's a form that goes with this practice, but the upshot of it is you're in their presence and there's a kind of loving exchange. They take an interest in you, that your care and well-being is important to them. There's a nourishment and a kind of exchange of nutrients, you could say, that happens and takes place. And then you internalize that state so that the conversation becomes a kind of part of your experience post the meeting, as the visualization kind of dissolves and is let go of. So that can be very soothing, very healing, but can also be a good practice to have. And like anything, if you do it regularly, you get quicker. You don't have to maybe take the whole 20 minutes or whatever it be. It might just be, just calling to mind the image of that has similar benefits. So those are just some of the resources and tools that I wanted to give a very, very brief overview of. And as I say, I'm very happy to expand upon those outside of the session. What I would like to propose for the practice that I'm suggesting we do is my own, how can I put this, riff. Yeah, maybe that's a good way of saying it. My own riff on a very traditional Tibetan practice, which is usually referred to as Tonglen. And that's the Tibetan way of spelling. And it's two words, Ton and Glen, which literally means giving and receiving, or giving and taking, or sending and receiving. It's about an exchange, fundamentally. So Tonglen practice in traditional Tibetan Buddhist forms was always used as a kind of ego-defeating purpose. Its intention, you could say, or its goal, was to lessen our attachment to our separate identity. And as a byproduct of doing that, it had a reputation for generating compassion. So in a traditional way of doing it, the secondary benefit is compassion, and the primary benefit is ultimately you realize the emptiness of your form, your kind of separate individual self, and your interdependence with everything else. So perhaps there's a mappability there. This version that we're going I'm going to invite you to take part of in a minute, shares the architecture of that, but is not a Buddhist practice. So in the Buddhist way of doing it, you, the ordinary self, would disappear. And in your place, you would basically visualize and construct your future fully realized Buddha self, your Buddha nature. And you would do the practice from that place. So that's what we're not going to do. But that's where it comes from. And it's, I think, important to kind of honor that and understand that. What we're going to do kind of occupies some of that territory, but doesn't require the Buddha nature part. Which is not really dissing the Buddha nature, that's there anyway, but simply kind of streamlines the thing for our purposes and makes the visualization simpler, apart from anything else. Also kind of strips out any kind of off-putting language around traditions that might be there. So this is a more psychological version, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. However, it's important that in the doing of this practice, for it to be effective, that we kind of encounter this paradox of what is often called effortless effort. So if you're halfway through this practice and you suddenly find yourself really trying, stop. Yeah? The idea being that the work is not done by any part of us that feels it is capable of doing the work. It's not heroic. It's not a striving. It's actually a matter of opening something, like an aperture through which some other power or force or energy or nature itself, one might say, can operate. So the idea being this is a natural process. that if we get too involved in, we can interfere with, or we will just give ourselves a headache, probably. That's probably what will happen. The other thing about the way we're going to do this practice, coming back to the title of the talk as well, is traditionally you do this practice on the behalf of others. So you might do it for someone who you know to be suffering or ill or facing a really difficult situation. And of course, I'm not saying you shouldn't do that. I very much would support those endeavours. And if we had time, we would add that in. The bit that's not often done traditionally, but I think is the core of the way we're going to do it, is to apply this method to oneself. So we're going to work with an image of ourself, and we're going to relate to that image of ourself, and we're going to, as a byproduct of that work, generate hopefully some compassion for ourselves. And that's not selfish, and that's not keeping that from anybody else. It's simply perhaps in the nature of restoring a certain part of balance. It's a bit like that thing on, you often hear on planes, don't you, about fit your own air mask if they fall from above before you start to help other people. It's got a little bit of that about it. It's like if you're not in good shape yourself, it's hard to help other people, and that's as true at the level of compassion as it is at any other level we might care to encounter it as. So is that okay with everyone? Is anyone not content to give this a go? And actually, my advice would be just completely tune me out and have 15 minutes of just sitting quietly with yourself. That might be more valuable to you at this point, more compassionate to you at this point. That's entirely possible. But for those of you that want to try, I will talk us through the structure of the exercise, and we'll do the brief version of it. So without further ado, and looking at the clock to stay on schedule, that's what we'll do. And Paul has very kindly lent me these tinctures, which I can sound at the end. So yeah, don't be startled. When we come to the end of the practice, I'll simply sound these symbols. I'll do it three times. And take your time coming out of that experience. Don't feel like you just have to jerk from one state to another. Okay, so if it feels comfortable for you, I would say it's often useful to close our eyes, simply because we're so visual as human beings. We often get distracted by visual stimuli. So if it's comfortable, close your eyes. If you're at risk of falling asleep, then open them, close them, move between states, half open, half close. And if you choose to keep your eyes open, that's also fine, but perhaps just allow your focus to go into soft focus a little bit. So don't really look at anything, just sort of rest your eyes on the middle distance or a point in front of you. And let's begin by being comfortable. So as comfortable as you can be in the chair you're in. Maybe with your feet on the floor, just to give you a good base and grounding. And then let's start by taking a couple of deeper breaths, settling breaths. So breathing in a bit more deeply than you would normally do. And then letting that breath go. And once again, breathing in deeply. And letting it go. And a third time, breathing in. And breathing out. And just bringing your attention to your body so that you include your physical experience just as it is. And then letting your awareness expand to include your emotional body, or your feelings, without getting caught in them or interfering, trying to change them, just letting them be there as much as you can, just as they are. Kindness to yourself, letting your experience be as it is. And then bringing that awareness again up to the level of the mind itself and the activities of the mind, the contents moving through your mind, thoughts, associations, memories, whatever might be there, and the patterns they make. And if you're really lucky, perhaps even noticing the spaces between thoughts, So breathing in with an awareness of those levels of your being gathered around your breath. And breathing out with that same awareness. And then I'd like to invite you to, for those of you that are quite visual, to visualize. And if you're not visual, then just see if it's possible to feel yourself in relationship to somewhere beautiful in nature. So this might be a real place that you know, or it might be a place you hope exists somewhere, or you've seen images of. It might be your garden, or a favorite beach, or a mountain, or a meadow. It doesn't matter at all. Just allow yourself to visualize or to come into relationship with somewhere beautiful in the natural world that welcomes and receives you. So see yourself and feel yourself to be in that place as you breathe in and as you breathe out. And really feel the ground beneath you, the good earth, that will be reliable and consistent, that will hold you and support you as we do this practice. And if at any point in the practice you feel you get lost, or things become a bit intense, or the experience isn't one that you wish for anymore, simply come back to this sense of yourself sitting in nature, with the air around you, the ground beneath you, perhaps the sun shining upon you, and all the other subtleties and details of the living, natural world abundantly present. So really breathe that in. Let that be as real as it can be for you. And then I'd like you to invite you to make an invitation yourself, to invite into this space in front of you a younger version of yourself, a version of yourself from an earlier point in time. So this could be you from yesterday, or this morning, or 3 years ago, or 20 years ago, or you as a child, or as an adolescent, or as a baby. And it's less about choosing or filtering and just more making the invitation and seeing who comes, who accepts, who's ready and willing and able to join you. And if no one comes, that's also okay. But if someone comes, some earlier aspect of yourself, really take the time to connect and to see them as clearly as you can. To visualize how they look, perhaps how they move, what they're wearing, the expression on their face. And more than that, also take the time to appreciate them, to feel into their hopes and aspirations, their potential, their desires for themselves, the goodness that dwells within them, and all the other qualities that become apparent when you really tune in with goodwill and with love to this earlier self. And as you appreciate these qualities within them, let yourself also become aware of all the things in this younger one's life that somehow cause them to be limited or to suffer. So maybe there are issues of health or illness. Maybe there are other people at this point in this younger one's life who are behaving less than well and hurting this one. Maybe there's a lack of confidence. Maybe there's other forms of distress. Just take the time to notice how that is, how that manifests, what that looks like and feels like. And as you do that, and as you get more intimate and subtle with that, you may also begin to notice in yourself, sat here in this beautiful natural setting, there arises a desire to be of help or of service to this younger one. And so, without making effort, without trying, just see if you can follow that arising instinct to help this younger self. And if you do that, one way of doing that is to use your breath. So it could be like this. As you breathe in, imagine that your breath, your in-breath, draws out of that younger part of you some aspect of that suffering. It's as if you pull it from them gently and it moves on your breath through your airway into you. And as you deepen your breath, that energy moves downwards until it comes into contact with your own heart, your heart center. And at the very center of your heart, it's as if there's a diamond, it's sometimes said, or a pearl, whose nature is, as it comes into contact with that distress, to suddenly blaze with light. So this might be a brilliant white light, or it might be a more rainbow-like light. Doesn't matter. But allow that breath as it touches your heart to come in contact with this, blazing with light. And that light energy transforms the heaviness, the density of the suffering into something valuable, into something of use. So now as you breathe out, imagine yourself breathing out that quality. You may know what it is, it may be mysterious, but just know that as you breathe it out, as you exhale it, it is received by that younger self. And let that cycling of breath continue gently, without effort, remembering yourself held by nature the whole time, the ground beneath you, breathing in the suffering, bringing it to the heart, having that transformative experience at the heart, and then breathing out whatever it might be, love or compassion or confidence or healing, something restorative, something that is necessary for this one to feel more whole. And this is the Tonglen, the giving and the receiving, or the taking and the sending. So if we had more time at this point, we could begin to invite others into the space with us. Specific others, or general others, or situations we're aware of in the world, in just the same way. But for today, with the times that we have, just allow that cycling of breathing in, transforming, breathing out, gently to come to rest now, and see that younger self, the image or the representation of yourself as a younger being, now dissolve or melt into light and absorb back into you. So literally melting into your heart from whence that part came. So once again, you're sitting in this beautiful natural space, just as you are, breathing in and breathing out. And then allow that natural space itself also to melt into light, to dissolve and to absorb into you, into your heart, inseparable from you. So that once again, you find yourself as you, seated here in this room with these people at this time, breathing in and breathing out. And just taking a minute or so to sit with nothing to do and nowhere to go, simply resting on the breath and in that open space. And at the end of the minute, I'll sound the cymbals. Okay, so as you're returning to the world, just read this poem that perhaps has something of the same energy about it. So this is a poem originally from the Spanish by Antonio Machado, but translated here by Robert Bly, known I'm sure to some of you. And this is how it goes. The wind one brilliant day called to my soul with an odour of jasmine. In return for the odour of my jasmine, I'd like all the odour of your roses. I have no roses. All the flowers in my garden are dead. Well then, I'll take the withered petals and the yellow leaves and the waters of the fountain. The wind left, and I wept, and I said to myself, "What have you done with the garden that was entrusted to you?" So what would it be to be better gardeners of our own soul, our own being, our own relationship to self, to put it in that kind of language? I'm not asking for an answer to that question, just raising that question itself. Gardening image is a good one. And I think I'll leave it there. There's plenty more one could say, but I'll stop there. We might have a minute or two for responses or questions, or otherwise please do catch me afterwards. Thank you very much. I put my email address on there as well, which if anyone wants a copy of these or wants to kind of follow up after today, please don't hesitate to do that. That's very welcome from my side. And I can also send you the MP3 recording of this, or we can do that by other means, but it exists, so it's easy enough to distribute it to you should you want it. So thank you very much. Thanks for having me.